View talk is different from this one, so please open it up if you're going to use it. And if anybody in here wants it, it's on the Paradoxa site. Rich team, make sure that that gets up there. Thank you, Rich, for doing that. So what are we doing this time, this morning, that we didn't do last time? Well, first of all, we're going to review what we were talking about last time, which was about worldviews. Because when I was here a few months ago and we talked about worldviews, we got through most of it, but not all of it. As is always the case, we burn up way more time than we have. So what I'm planning to do today is to review that, and then the end of it is going to be different in that as I work through some of the explanations of how we compare them, I'm going to be talking about some of the things that Ken Samples talked about in his book, A World of Difference. And I want to make sure to give him credit for that, because this book is a fantastic book. I would strongly recommend you read it. It's easy to read, but it's absolutely full of interesting stuff about worldviews. All right, so we're going to first start out with a definition of what a worldview is. Part of the reason that understanding a definition of worldview is that the term gets used so often that if we don't have at least some kind of a term to start with or some kind of definition, we could be talking past each other rather than with each other. How many of you in this room have actually had discussions with people about their worldviews? Okay. Looks like about 30%. And in those discussions, was the term worldview really well described? Did you have it well defined?
No. It depends on who you talk
to. And with whom was it well defined?
Well, I took a test on the internet. It says, do you want to know where are you in the worldview? I have to pat myself on the back pretty high because my worldview is based on the Bible.
So it assessed the quality of your worldview? Or how to explain that?
The worldview according to the Bible is different than what the worldview would be without, because he does not believe in the Bible or believe in God. And so whenever I talk to somebody, I say, listen, is my worldview according to the Bible or by God, creation, everything is connected.
Okay. All right. So we've had discussions with people what a worldview is. We define it as a worldview being a set of beliefs about fundamental aspects of reality. In other words, this is so deep that without them you don't have a worldview. What are the elements of a worldview? Well, first of all, the way that Ken Funk, who I'm borrowing some of this from, and I want to make sure I give him credit for it. He talks about this little diagram where it says worldview lenses come in four comfortable and convenient models. Now, that itself presumes a worldview, that there's only four other worldviews, and he wasn't trying to make it that narrow. But if you look at this, you can see you have a modern, a postmodern, traditional, and imperial worldview. There are many, many, many more than that. But what he wants to show is that there are that a worldview is very much like a lens. It colors and interprets what it is that you experience. And then there's elements of the worldview. What exactly constitutes a worldview? Well, we have a series of things here that were popping up on the screen, and we're going to go into each one with a little bit of detail because we spent most of the time last time doing this. But these things are what most people who study worldviews believe are the central features of a worldview. Now, could you add to this? Sure. You could take some of these and divide them up. Furthermore, you could take some of these and they would overlap others. Not all of them are completely distinct from everything else. And then the last thing I want to make sure I get across when I'm talking about this is that as I'm talking to you, I'm operating through a worldview. So even what I'm doing as I describe these things presumes a certain epistemology, metaphysics, cosmology, etc. So we're always going to be in a little bit of trouble when we're doing these kinds of descriptions, but we can still do them. I'm not an intellectual skeptic in believing that you can't know these kinds of things. So the first one is epistemology. And what we're talking about when we're talking about epistemology is what are we talking about that we know? How do we know what we know? How do we justify what we know? What is knowledge? What is the difference between knowledge and belief? There's some questions put up here like, is knowledge merely a state of the brain? what do some people believe knowledge is? Can you know something independent of a mind? Probably not. You have to have a mind to know something. But could knowledge be something that you keep after your brain is gone? Well, in a Christian worldview, what happens to the us that remains after the body is gone? Are there memories? Apparently so. At least the Bible seems to suggest that. So the question, is knowledge merely a state of the brain? The answer for a Christian would be, no, it's not merely a state of the brain, because there's a time at which you know something. You know God, you know your position with respect to God after death, that is disentangled from the brain, that there is no brain there. Is it a manifestation of a cosmic mind? There are some people who believe that all of what appears to be intelligent about the universe is because there's some cosmic mind, and this all is put together is the cosmic mind. Is that what we mean by knowledge? That knowledge is merely its manifestation of the cosmic mind? Does it come only from sense experience? Is there some other way of acquiring knowledge other than sense experience? What do you think? If yes, what would the response be? If the answer is yes, what would it be? Experience?
Experiments.
Well, aren't experiments measured through our sense experience?
Not necessarily. They can be measured through test equipment.
Okay, but how do you look at the test equipment without your senses? Do we know things that we call spiritual? You need some more coffee, folks. This is a Christian room with some Christian people in it.
I'll go with the yes.
Okay. Through the Christian worldview, do we believe that we have spiritual knowledge that is independent of the senses? Yes. Yes. In the back, we started yes. We made some concessions. We're starting to think about coffee. It's probably starting to get through us now. So we're livening up here.
Maybe you should add the word physical.
Well, what other senses are there?
My term is there a spiritual sense, quote unquote. And so
okay, then I would give it that. Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there anything that we can know for certain?
No.
We can know that the only thing I can know for certain is that I exist.
Anything else? I mean, I exist is all I can know for certain.
Yeah,
okay, I'll start here. Al, go ahead.
I was reading about the brain. The brain is a great organ, but it can be fooled, and it can fool you into believing so many things that are not so. In other words, they've done experiments with people that have, say, a phantom limb, where they have no leg. The leg's cut off.
Okay.
Or an arm. And they can fool the brain into thinking that yes, there is. You have an arm. And the brain will say yes. You know, so it can be fooled into doing that. Also, with electrodes in your brain, a tiny current can make you believe or not believe, can give you a near-death experience, out-of-body experiences, all that. So all that stuff there comes from the brain.
Well, that's one worldview. That's one way of looking at it, Al. And that's my point. But here's the instant question. Is there anything one can know for certain? Now, you can say we can plug things in our head and change the things we think. I don't think anybody here is going to dispute that. But are you saying that there is no way to know anything for certain?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so, because of our brain.
Okay. Here, and then I'll move up and to the right.
One's a philosophy that one cannot know anything for certain is on very shaky ground, because the statement itself is a statement that you can know something for certain. So when your philosophy starts off on self-contradiction, you're on shaky ground, you know. And I claim that the electrodes in the brain kind of thing, those don't create memory. Those are accessing pre-existing memories in the brain. They're not creating them out of thin air. It's stuff that exists in the brain that those electrodes can't access or manipulate.
Okay, so what is it that we know for certain then? Or are you saying you cannot know something for certain?
No, I'm saying you can know certain things.
Well, things for certain is different than certain things.
Yeah, not everything can you know for certain, but some things.
Okay, I feel like I'm in a philosophy class again. I'm liking this. I like this. This is good. All right, so I know certain things for certain.
Yes.
Okay, that's where we're headed. Up the row, was there some other?
I agree with that.
Okay.
I know certain things for certain.
Okay.
Like
sir.
The sun gives heat.
Okay.
Yeah, I would go along with that. That's what I was thinking about raising my hand. You commonly speak of when things stick to a certain science, well, like math. If you could just stick within that science, and it's okay, you build on each other, and you see there's certainty there. But if we try to take that out to another science, like apply math to sociology or apply math to something in the physical world, then our certainty becomes less.
Okay, so there are some things we can know because they are analytic or because they're bound by a set of rules that are inviolable.
That's
like mathematics. I mean,
yeah,
2 plus 2 in base 10 is going to be 4.
That's right. We certainly know that 2 plus 2 equals 4. There's no doubt there. And another instance that I think people say they're certain is in like their own faith. If they just start from some rules, they can be more abstract, like doing to others as you would have them do it to you. And then you can apply other things with certainty from those rules.
Good. Okay. I see a whole lot of hands coming up here. I'm going to go one more sweep to the left, and then I'm going to move on. Sir?
I am certain that what is certain is not as important as what is possible.
Okay. Good. I like that. We're actually getting into the problem of certainty and what the problem of epistemology is. Because the reason that it's part of our worldview, the reason that it's inescapable is for exactly the reasons that we're talking about here. Look at the different ways that we talk about knowledge and what we can know. Different people, for different reasons, have different ways of looking at it. The real super skeptic ends up with something, as John called it, I think you called it, self-referentially absurd. If you didn't use that, it is self-referentially absurd. And then other things, if you get away from that kind of really harsh skepticism, there are some things that you could know for certain. Ross talked about, I know I exist. You know, cogito ergo sum, I believe, therefore I am. Or I know, therefore I am. So we have these different ranges of things that we can or cannot know for certain. Where they lie is the epistemology that we're talking about in terms of worldview. Metaphysics. Metaphysics is talking about what is the real, essential nature, ultimate reality. Is everything just matter and energy? If it is, does that not create a particular kind of worldview?
Absolutely.
Yes, it does. And in which way?
Well, if everything is just matter and energy, number one, everything is random. So therefore, number two, you can know nothing for certainty. Because how do you know 2 plus 2 equals 4? That might just be a result of a random collection of molecules. So in other words, you don't know really what to believe in absolutes when everything is just collection of random molecules. There is no absolutes.
Okay, so
you can know nothing for sure.
But in if everything were just matter and energy, you're presupposing randomness, which also supposes what? The particular view of quantum mechanics or some other kind of physics.
You have no free will. I mean, you have no free will if everything is just matter.
Okay, now let's move to something else. What if I were a Hindu and I don't know anything about quantum mechanics? Would everything still be matter and energy?
If you're a pantheist, yeah.
So where I'm going with that is that we look at matter and energy through the lenses of a sophisticated 21st century scientific viewpoint. There are other people who exist today who don't look through the world that way. And some people who are sophisticated 21st century people who answer the question, is it just matter and energy, in different ways. That colors their worldview, colors our worldview. Truth. We will get more into this at the end, particularly when we start getting into how do we test worldviews and compare them? Because that's ultimately what I want to do today, believe it or not, despite how much time we're spending on this. Correspondence truth. Correspondence truth means is a statement is true if and only if it corresponds to or what it describes about reality obtains. That's kind of a philosophical way of describing it. In other words, if I say snow is white, that statement is true if indeed snow is white. Coherence theory of truth, what that describes is something is true if it's part of a coherent scheme of things, all of which are true. In other words, coherence is what defines what's true. If it doesn't work with respect to all the other things in its theory, it's incoherent, it's not true. Pragmatic means that I don't know whether anything is true or not true, but if it seems to work for me, it's as good as true. These are very, very superficial definitions. Did you have something you want to say, Ross?
You're already assuming that there is truth, which in itself is a worldview.
Yes, it is.
A lot of worldviews that say there is no truth.
Absolutely. Notice what I said there. Yeah.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That's
I just want to make sure you're certain about that. Is reality discovered empirically or is it discovered otherwise? That's part of what we're talking about when we look at metaphysics. Cosmology, despite the fact that we have Hugh Ross here occasionally, who talks about cosmology from a different viewpoint, what we're talking about is just the origin of the universe, life, and humanity. Life and humanity go into cosmology here for this definition. If life is just, if the universe is just a chance event, then it has one way of looking at the world. If we're created, there's an entirely different worldview. Did life originate purely by natural causes, or did humanity originate accidentally as a result of some kind of evolution? Your answers to that are going to color your worldview. And, by the way, your worldview will color the answers to that. That's part of the interesting thing about worldview is that it's hard to have a worldview and look at things without looking at things through the worldview. There's a circularity to it that's fascinating and it's problematic also. If we were to spend all day talking about that, we wouldn't get through it. The big question about the purpose of the cosmos is called teleology. And you've probably seen the word telos in your Bible studies, and it means the end or the purpose of something in Greek. Is there any reason or purpose or end to our life or the cosmos? And if so, whose purpose is it? And what is the purpose? That's what we're talking about when we talk about teleology. Theology. Now, if I were an atheist, would I include theology as part of a worldview?
Mythology.
Say it again?
Mythology.
I might actually go replace theology with mythology, which is one of the reasons I want to get across that these seven things that we talk about as elements of a worldview can be subdivided or could be replaced with something else depending on your worldview. Although most philosophers would look at this and agree. Some would disagree. Jamie?
I would say that an atheist does have a theology. He has a view about the idea of God. In a sense.
Yeah. If we would define an atheist as someone who says there is no God, then he is making a statement about God. But what about the atheist who says, I don't see a God. I don't know anything about a God. Maybe God is just a term that you folks come up with because you experience something I don't experience. Would that atheist then be somebody who's making a theological claim? Or is he just asking an open question?
It's an agnostic.
Is an agnostic? Okay, because I want to get the labels right so we're defining our terms. Is an agnostic somebody who says, I don't know there's a God, or is he saying one cannot know there's a God?
Probably both.
No, they're two different things.
There's a closed-minded agnostic, and there's an open-minded agnostic, and there's actually then a seeking agnostic, too, beyond the open-minded.
Okay, and distinguish the three, because I've seen some definitions of agnostic being very hard, and then the hard definition of agnostic is one who says you cannot know. So of course they're going to say I don't know, but neither can you know nor can anyone else know. That's one definition of agnosticism.
Well, since an agnostic says I don't know if there's a But to say no one can know that there's a God means you've closed the loop and you're really denying there's a God.
Well, no, actually you're not denying there's a God. You're just denying that anyone could know it.
It could not be certain.
Yeah.
Well, you'd be denying right. that there's a God that could make it, it makes any difference.
No, you're just saying you don't know that the God is there or that anybody else could know.
Yeah, but if you're saying that...
Because you could be making differences and you don't know them.
Yeah, if you're saying, therefore, that if my basis is I don't know, then you're jumping from I don't know to you don't know, which is more of an absolutist basis.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's... I wanted to play with that for a little while. I'm not going to play with it for much longer because we're not going to get where we need to go here. But the reason I wanted to play with that is that we need to understand that when we use these terms like agnostic, they're not as simple as we might think. And it's extremely important to define your terms when you're having discussions like this. I spent about an hour last week trying to compare worldviews. And the amount of time that I thought it would actually take to do it successfully was way longer than I spent on it. And it was an easy one. I just compared, you know, the epistemology, the axiology, the theology, all those other, all the ologies together with a worldview that I was familiar with. Extremely, extremely difficult. Part of the reason is because of this, that once you start trying to define terms, you have to really dig deep into the literature because there are so many different variations on even things that we think we know, like agnosticism. So theology could be divided up into, let's say, for some secularist who says, I don't know anything about a God or whether there is a God, and replace it with mythology. Or it could be what we consider theology in our own sense, as we know there's a God or believe there's a God, and that God has some kind of effect in this universe. So whether we have a theology or don't have a theology, arguably, it's going to play a role in our worldview. Independent of the study of anthropology, the scientific application of anthropology, when we talk about anthropology for the purpose of a worldview, we're talking about the question of the nature of human beings. In other words, are humans basically good people, or are we basically evil people? Or are we neither one of them? We're a mixture of the two. If you talk to some folks, they'll say, you're born naturally good. And it's just as you get educated or tormented by the people around you who aren't so good, you turn bad. Now, you've heard that. You've heard people say, well, education will solve all the evil of the world. I don't buy that, but you know, I'm not here to try and sell you my political viewpoint. The bottom line is the question of whether people are fundamentally good or fundamentally evil is a part of our anthropology or anthropological viewpoint. Free will. John talked about the problem of what if all you are is your brain and your brain is nothing but matter, and we believe quantum physics is that everything is just these random actions within the subatomic particles, do we really have free will, or are we determined by these subatomic particle reactions?
You'd have to be determined because the effect cannot be greater than the cause.
So our scientific ideas are going to determine in some part our anthropology. Because if we truly believe that we're nothing but a collection of matter and energy, and there's nothing more to our mind than this epiphenomenon of, you know, firing of C fibers in our brain, we're stuck with some interesting consequences, some interesting philosophical consequences and practical consequences, like determinism and the absence of real free will, that free will is, on some views, merely an illusion. Such a person would have, on that third bullet point, a belief that humans merely are advanced animals. And in some philosophical circles, this question here, is there such a thing as human nature, is a stupid question. They believe that, no, there actually is no human nature. How could there be a human nature? We're just animals. We just have to look at these creatures that we call humans in a particular way, and it isn't a way that has a nature. Will that affect our worldview? Absolutely. Anthropology is central to a worldview because we are all what? Humans. Yeah, we're kind of stuck there.
Animals.
We're human animals. Or at least he's an animal.
More importantly, we're in relationship, so we've got to have some model for interaction with
them. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's very well put. We as people will always value things. Or, if you don't want to say we always will, we're always capable of it. And when we value things, we value everything from how much money we have, how valuable the money is, how much we value each other, how much we value ideas. This whole study of what we consider valuable is called axiology. And we all have an axiology. One way or another, every single worldview will have an axiology. What is the highest good? Is it peace? Is it self-actualization? Is it pleasure? Is it knowledge? Are there things that have value that are intrinsic? In other words, they are valuable regardless of whether we put some personal value on them. And who determines what that value is? Are the only determiners of value the people who hold the things or the people who want the things? And more important to a Christian worldview is, what about our values in terms of morals? Are they objective? Is there an objective morality? Or is it entirely something that I come up with myself? Is it discovered or is it created? That whole, well, those series of questions that deal with whether morality is created, whether it's subjective, objective, whether it can be independent of somebody's thought, those are all part of the study or the notion of axiology. And it, I think of all the things that come up in worldviews, the one thing that you could go to first and talk about to separate yourself from somebody else or at least understand where they're coming from in their worldview is their axiology. What do they hold as valuable? From there, you'll start to understand their notions of anthropology and epistemology, because what we personally value will determine a lot about what else we believe. So, should we even care about other people's worldviews? What do you think?
Yes.
And why should we?
Because if we're going to communicate with them, we have to have at least some understanding of how they view truth and reality.
Sir?
It also drives their behavior, doesn't it?
Say it again?
Won't their worldview drive their behavior?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think so. I mean, if you have those seven features of worldview, if nothing else, that last one we talked about, axiology, will it drive their behavior? Sure, if I find money valuable, what am I going to do? Find ways to get money. If I find people valuable, what am I going to do? I'm going to find ways to interact with people. So you're absolutely right. What other reasons are there that we should care about worldview? Go ahead, Al.
Yeah, Mark, I think that your worldview will change as you age. You know, I don't mm-hmm. have the same worldview now that I had when I was 20 or 30.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have seen so many things, and I have experienced so many things in my life that my whole view had changed. And a lot of times I looked back and I said, at my life, what the heck was that all about? Why did I do that? You know, why didn't I do that? Or, you know, so your worldview keeps changing as your experiences grow and grow. I think your worldview is not a static thing.
Do you personally value something differently now than you did earlier? Is that one of the things that changed?
Yes.
Back to the axiology. I'm telling you right now that if you look at axiology, that's going to be the one thing that's going to make a big difference. And you're able to identify that your worldview shifted because of your values shifting. Something you found valuable before was not valuable now, and maybe something you found that was valuable.
Yeah. An example, when I was young, in my 20s and 30s, I was chasing girls, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because that was what we all do. We want to mate, procreate. But now, I can't do it anymore. My worldview has changed. What is that all about?
I'm going to sweep from the right to the left. Go ahead.
One of the reasons we can care about other people's worldview is because, I speak for myself, I constantly want to tune up my own worldview. And by seeing how somebody else values something or sees something differently than I do, it challenges me. And I can say, well, I'll stick with what I got, or I see what they're saying. Maybe, you know, maybe I value something that I shouldn't be, or that I want to value something else, and I see it in someone else. It gives me a reason to question and think through my own worldview.
Now, that's an interesting concept, that you look at your worldview, you test it against something. What is it that you're testing it against? Reality? Something that you've thought before and that you find differently now?
Well, I guess for me, I test it against two things. I guess I test it against what I see in the world around me to see if I like that better in some cases. And I also test it against what the Bible says, which I see as the highest ideal of a worldview, to see if, am I seeing things the way I'm supposed to be seeing them, or in a healthy way.
Got it. Thank you. Ted.
Well, a thing that we have to enter into this conversation is the work of the Holy Spirit in making us aware and giving us extra information. It's like you have a computer and all you're working on is the basic operating system when you boot it up. Then you load in your Windows operating system or your Mac operating system. The system is now a trillion-fold more powerful than it was just reading ones and zeros with the basic operating system. So you're given power you didn't have before, so the worldview is definitely superior and altered by the presence of the Holy Spirit when the good Lord comes in energy. And we definitely want to alter other people and invite them to receive the Holy Spirit, invite them to get the Lord, and the worldview will change radically, and that person will become from being spiritually dead to spiritually alive. Very important thing that would bear on all the characteristics of a worldview. And this doesn't deal with intelligence or knowledge, particularly. It's God's sovereign gift, and you're elevated to a being that you weren't before.
So the reason we should care about worldviews is that the Holy Spirit works on a worldview? Or what's your answer to that question?
Your worldview is altered. It would be like if you were to go to your vehicle and half the sensors were to go out, or the computer were to go out, it was running at a barely running down the road, and then all of a sudden someone reloaded the operating system out, and all the sensors are now working, or you were blind, or you were unconscious, and now you bring the person back to consciousness. Everyone's in a daze, in a darkness. Their worldview is darkened. Their view of life is darkened. They can't correctly assess these conditions. We can.
You know,
sovereign gift from God.
You and Ross both pointed out something that we're going to get into right now, as soon as I get through these couple of questions, which is that worldviews change and can be compared to something. And what you're saying, Ted, if I understand you right, is that the Christian worldview, as you've seen it, is more effective. It creates, it's like a new operating system or an operating system in a machine or a device that didn't have one before. So.
Yes.
And that's the first time I've heard anybody use a computer analogy, and I think it's actually a very good one. I believe it was C.S. Lewis who said something like, Christianity is what allows me, the sunrise allows me to see Christianity, and Christianity is what allows me to see the sunrise. They're both related to each other. The sunrise lets them know that God is there, and His knowledge of God allows him to see the sunrise in a particular way. We should care about the world you others hold because of all these things, but one big, big, huge thing, and that is, if somebody else holds a different worldview, and the definitions that we believe about the seven elements are different for them than they are for us, are we going to have a communication problem? A huge one. So one of the fundamental things we have to realize is that when somebody else has a different worldview, we may not even be speaking the same language, even though we speak the same language. So we may be speaking in English together, but our terms are not identical. Worldviews will necessarily alter the terminology or the values of the terms. So we have to start to crawl into those. Can a person's worldview be changed? And if so, how? Well, we just had three examples from Al, from Ross, from Ted on how worldviews can be changed. At least two of the people here described worldviews that changed within themselves. One of them described that he goes out of his way to change his worldview, or at least adjust it. And is there any way to show that one worldview is superior to another or to all of them? Well, that's exactly what we're going to get into now. Ken Samples, in his book, A World of Difference, shameless plug, I love the book, I love Ken Samples, gives a 9-point test for worldviews. And one of the things we have to say up front to condition this is that no one of these tests is dispositive alone. In other words, you can't look at just one of these and say, if this is right and all the rest don't work, it's sufficient. It's not. You need all nine. And we'll go into them really quickly here. Now, one of the things that Ken Samples uses as an analogy is he refers to another philosopher and says that one way of looking at a worldview is to see a worldview as a hypothesis, a very grand, large hypothesis, but a hypothesis nevertheless. And then he starts to describe the tests as if you were testing a hypothesis. So think about that in the background. The first one is coherence. Is the worldview logically consistent? John earlier talked about a question about, you know, you can't know anything for certain, or I can't know anything for certain, and yet you say that with certainty. And that is self-referentially absurd. That ends up being logically inconsistent. So if we start out asking the question, is the worldview or the hypothesis consistent? It has to be consistent with logic. Coherence is what we're talking about here. If it doesn't work together, it falls apart. What do we mean by parsimony? And I don't mean frugal or tight or something like that. Okay, parsimony, Ken Samples describes as a balance test, a balance between complexity in a hypothesis and simplicity. And for a lot of people who are philosophers and philosophers of science in particular, who are concerned about hypotheses and laws of nature and law-like statements, one of the rules that is used is called the rule of parsimony, or Occam's razor. You heard of Occam's razor? Mm-hmm. It's not something you buy at the store. If you buy one, I'd like to have it. I'll buy it from you. My axiology holds that in very high esteem. So what would Occam's razor say about a hypothesis?
The simplest explanation is usually the best.
The simplest explanation is usually the best. That's close.
Preferred.
It's close. Preferred. Yes. And what, when we're looking at Occam's razor, it applies to a comparison. So you don't use Occam's razor on just one theory. You'd use it on a set of theories. And you look at all of them and say, okay, first of all, are there any unnecessary presumptions? If there are no unnecessary presumptions, you move on and you keep looking to find the one that's most elegant. There's the theory of beauty. You know, one of the ways that you test a theory for its effectiveness is how beautiful it is. Parsimony, or its ability to have as few extraneous as possible, is what helps us understand or helps us assess theories. It doesn't necessarily mean it's true. You could have a very perfectly parsimonious theory and it could be dead false. Parsimony doesn't guarantee truth. It merely helps us select among theories. Ted, go ahead.
I was going to say, among competing theories, they all have to have the same scope. They have to explain all the data you're trying to understand. As well as being simple, if you leave out some of the data, it's not as good of an explanation as one that includes all the data you're trying to figure out or understand. So if you cut away too much and you lose explanatory power, then you've cut too much. Then it's not being parsimonious. It's being inadequate. So you have to adequately explain all the phenomena, as well as being minimalist, as well as there being no extraneous stuff. So there's two parts to it.
So how would we apply that to a worldview? It's pretty easy to apply to scientific theories, pretty easy to apply to hypotheses. How would a worldview be parsimonious?
There's too much data.
You're already blowing up, right? Exploding your head. As a matter of fact, worldviews are extraordinarily data rich. They're data rich as a human experience. And it's almost impossible to scale or identify human experience or to put it on a scale and say, you know, it's equal to this or equal to that. So I won't even get into how difficult that is. But parsimony works just this way. If my worldview requires so much explanation that conflicts with itself, which is the coherence problem, or requires me to have more ideas or thoughts than it needs to compared to somebody else's, theirs is simpler and more elegant and achieves exactly the same ends, parsimony would say you ought to be looking at that other one. That's how it works in a worldview. Sir?
Can you give an example?
No. And the reason is, without me, you know, going exhaustively into one worldview or another, I couldn't say, here's the entire scope. But let me try and give you something. If I were a Christian, I would believe that there is one and only one God, and that anything that happens in the world that appears to be unprovable by science, for example, the giant gaps or the origins of life, gaps in the fossil record, the origins of life, that's explicable by one God. If I were an animist and I believe that there's all sorts of gods, or a polytheist, there's all these other gods out there. All of these gods, you know, one God, he just handles the rain part, and there's another God who handles the sunrise part, and there's another dude who kind of takes care of the oceans, and another one who does all of these other things. I would be asking the question, well, if you have all these different gods, why? I've got one, mine is simple, economical, and it answers all of the questions that your multitude of gods does. Can you explain why your multitude of gods works better than my singular God? Now, a whole bunch of questions are going to arise from that, but that's one way of looking at parsimony. Do I have multiple gods to answer the questions that I can do it with one? Sir?
Isn't an important aspect of parsimony disprovability? This is the fewer statements you have to test, the easier it is to find out whether the theory is right or wrong.
That's one of the advantages of parsimony. Absolutely it is. It is not the reason for parsimony, but it is one of the advantages of it. Now, Ted talked about explanatory power, that a hypothesis, or in our case a worldview, has to explain things. If it doesn't explain the things that are real, if it's not broad enough to encompass everything that exists in the world, is it effective? Part of a worldview. It's not effective. It isn't effective. Explanatory power and scope. Does it explain a broad scope of phenomena, and does it do so in sufficient detail? If it doesn't, then there may be reasons for it. No worldview is ever complete. We don't have an exhaustive knowledge of the physical universe. So we can't explain all physical details. But if I look at the Quran, and I look at the Bible, when I read the Quran, I see a very vague, difficult to understand text. It doesn't explain a lot of the things that the Bible explains very, very clearly. The explanatory power of Islam, if I'm going to base it on the Quran, is less than the explanatory power of Christianity if I'm going to base it on the Bible. That's one way of comparing worldviews. So explanatory and power and scope are extremely important. If they don't explain what the worldview is there for, it's not a good competitor. And we have a couple of others. Correspondence. We talked about correspondence theory of truth earlier. It pops back up now. Does the worldview correspond with the way the world really is, in fact, and in human experience? And the reason that we talk about human experience here in a hypothesis involves worldviews is that if human experience, all of humanity, not just one individual's experience, conflicts with a worldview, is that worldview even worth considering? It might be. But if you're going to compare that with others, especially one that may have, say, the first three very well covered, and we get now into four, and one explains or corresponds well to human experience and the other one does not, which one would you pick? The one that does. Again, the purpose in showing these is that there is a way to compare worldviews, that you can't just sit back, as some subjectivists would say, and say, well, everybody has their own view, and just, you know, that's the way the world is. Yeah, they do have their own view. But some views are better than others, and we are allowed to say that. If you fall into the kind of postmodern drivel that, you know, everybody has their own opinion, or you can't, anything you read is just an interaction with the reader and the material and doesn't have any real meaning except for what you derive from it, you don't even have, you're hopeless. You don't have any way of comparing your worldview with anybody else's. But in fact, you can. Sir?
You know, but my siblings are in that camp, and what I find is it's really just trying to construct an absolute model for dodging.
For evasion?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you try to push on the envelope to test that model in which the dodging is going on, then you just get shut off because someone's not seeking. They're just sensing to build a little fort around their dodging.
And they're dodging what?
The gospel.
And they're, why are they dodging it?
Because they think, well, the problem is God's authority.
Okay.
Recognize that God gave you a gift you couldn't have made yourself, then you also at some point have to say, well, you know, okay, he created the universe, but I'm not going to listen to him. And that's really where it happens.
So they have a value of something. They like their independence of God. They like their ability to do whatever they want without being held accountable. They have these values. And we could spend an entire hour or longer on trying to figure out how do you go about dealing with that problem, which is ultimately the problem that naturally flows from an understanding of the difference in worldviews. How do you penetrate another person's worldview? How do you talk to somebody who says, well, that's just the way you think. I think differently, and that's it.
Well, then that person obviously, well, often, this is my experience. People just don't want them. They want to change the subject.
And sometimes it'll go there. You know, they'll do subject change, or they'll evade, or they will do something else. There are ways of hooking those people. We don't have time to talk about that today because that would be a really great all by itself talk or interaction or facilitation. But how do you go about engaging people with a different worldview? Ross?
People that hold that position are as absolutist about that position as they accuse us of being absolutist about our position.
Yeah.
And when you point that out to them, it stuns them.
Well, who wouldn't want to be God of their own world?
That's right.
Well,
that's where we all start out.
How about the verification? You say that God created the world, the universe. Can it be verified or falsified?
I think that's exactly the thing that no, you're presuming that. The argument, see, the verification question is a good one. And the question you're bringing up is, can Christianity, because that's the context in which you're talking now in this Christian class, can Christianity verify or falsify any of its claims? That's an open question. Could Hinduism or Islam or atheism verify or falsify its claims? All of its claims. Or at least as many claims as there in principle could be challenged. And it's important to talk about in principle because some things like subatomic particles and the testing certain theories of subatomic particles are beyond our ability to do practically right now. We just don't have the energy or the technological skill or wherewithal to knock these things against each other with enough force. But in principle, if we had the device to do it, we could verify or falsify part of that. The same thing applies with worldviews, is that it may be impossible right this very second to falsify or verify some broad feature of it, but it could be, in principle, verified or falsified. For example, the end of the world is, in principle, falsifiable. Okay?
Just wait long enough.
That's right. But it is, in principle, falsifiable. Either Jesus will return and do what he said he was going to do, or he will not. That's in principle falsifiable. So that part of the worldview is interesting in terms of Christianity because there is at least an in principle verification scheme for some of its most important aspects. When you go back historically, is it hard to prove or disprove historical things? Yes. Matter of fact, it's almost impossible. But we don't have to prove beyond all doubt. We only have to prove beyond reasonable doubt. And when you get beyond when you get to somebody who won't accept reasonable doubt, then you have to ask yourself whether it's rational. If you won't accept reason, then what would you accept? Well, I have to see it absolutely right in front of my eyes. Well, it was 2,000 years ago. I'm sorry, but you weren't there. What next? Pragmatics. Is it socially and individually workable in real life? Again, the worldview test, Ken Samples tells us, no one of these is sufficient. So pragmatics is socially and individually workable in real life. If I had a worldview that made it impossible for me to talk to other human beings, or made other human beings so valueless that I could treat them like rocks and shove them into fires or put them underneath steamrollers and things like that. Do we even have steamrollers anymore? Yeah. Asphalt rollers. Asphalt. Okay. All right. I'm older than I think I am.
In Fresno.
Dad.
Whenever you're in Fresno.
In Fresno. All right.
They still call them steamrollers.
They still do?
Yeah. Even if not steam, they still call them.
Okay. Saves me. Thank you. I'm really not 118 years old. So it has to be socially and individually workable in real life. If it isn't, then you have to question whether it's as effective as a worldview as its competitors. And the last three here, perfect timing, we just have a few more minutes left. Existential satisfaction. Ken has a lot of big words because he's a philosopher, and that's why philosophers live with big words. What we mean by existential satisfaction is, does the worldview really solve the problem of people's desire for meaning and purpose and significance? If it doesn't, there are at least some that do. And it gives you good reason to separate one worldview from another. If I look at Christianity, will it give me meaning, purpose, and significance? Yes, it could. And for many people, it does. And arguably, if you're a real Christian, it absolutely would. Because Jesus gives you meaning, purpose, and significance. Others don't. Well, some do better than others. Some do better than others. And that's part of the thing we're talking about. How do you test and compare them?
But some of these tests, like number 7, seem to me subjective. They appeal to the subjective. And why can you say that it's objectively necessary that it has to appeal to meaning, purpose, and significance?
Well, yes. And the reason is that humans, this existential satisfaction talks about humanity, and that a worldview is a human worldview, and humans hold it, and anthropology is one of the elements. So how much value you want to put on number 7 is an open question. be far, far less for some than others. But like I said earlier, the nine tests, no one of them is sufficient. No one of them is sufficient. But they're all necessary to at least examine, to compare one worldview against another. Go ahead.
I think dealing with several, the fact that human beings universally crave for purpose and meaning. Any theory that you construct has to answer that question or that phenomenon.
It appears so. I mean, anthropologically, the answer to that question is probably so. But again, this is one of nine. And you'll see here, number eight really should be number nine, because do multiple lines of evidence accumulate to justify the worldview? If you look at just one line of evidence, in other words, it's existentially satisfying or one of the others that we're talking about, that's good, but that's not good enough. It should have multiple lines looking at the question of, let's go back one here, correspondence, verification, and pragmatics. If one of those is missing, you're going to have a problem. If three of them are missing, you have a big problem. If all of them are present and robust, then what you have is a really, arguably, really good worldview or a strong competitor. Because in the end, that's exactly what we're looking at, is competitive competence. Is one worldview, the worldview you hold or are examining, capable of competing with other worldview based on the standards we talked about, containing those elements, and the various things that we use to compare them? If it is, it's worth pursuing. If it's not, it's worth reevaluating. One of the important features of this, though, is that a good worldview will be able to at least adapt to changes in knowledge. A Christian worldview from 2,000 years ago that didn't understand what stars really were would be different than a Christian worldview today. Even though we would be still worshiping the same Christ, still having the same basic faith, the worldview would be slightly different because it did not know certain features of the universe. This is why Hugh Ross does what he does. He and his team research things in science to find new reasons to believe. And as he does that, it enriches the worldview. And we adapt to these new discoveries. If we do not do that, and the worldview is incompetent to do that, the worldview is dubious. That's exactly the end of our hour and some time. This is the first time I've ever actually gotten through one on time. So throw out that. All right. Thank you all very much. It's end of watch. It's time to go. And next week, Hugh Ross will be back, and you'll have a real speaker. All right. Take care. Thank you.